Folks, and welcome to the Anime Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about a theory that we've been espousing in our group chat for a while, which is that the UK has overtaken the United States of America in batshit crazy terms. So we're going to be discussing that, trying to really get down to the exact moment, you would say, the sort of the crossing of the Rubicon of when the UK really started eating the frog pills. So today I'm joined with the other regular co-host, Alex, who's going under the Jitsi handle of Mourning Diana. How are you getting on, Alex?
Well, I'm quite upset because I'm Mourning Diana.
Succinct. And we also have Suzanne with us, who is going under the post-ironic handle of Brex Shit. How are you getting on?
I'm good. Thanks very much.
Wow, very chatty, the both of you today. Right, so let's just get straight into the brass tacks. As we were saying in the intro, at some point, the UK has gone off a cliff edge where it comes to how strange and weird it is. Now, that's not to say that it wasn't always a strange place to live in, but now, as someone that used to live there, admittedly in Scotland, but you know, it's still the United Kingdom, now living in Ireland and seeing the news that comes out of it, I basically don't believe it's a real place, because the media culture, the politics, the day-to-day layman just seem to be so batshit that it's hard to believe that it's not some sort of elaborate and complicated modern art piece. If it all turned out that it was basically a Charles Kaufman film, then that would make more sense to me than the actuality of the situation. So we'll start with some light questions. Alex, have you got a theory of the exact pinpoint of when the UK went strange?
Yeah, it's the name of my Jitsi handle. The death of Diana, I can't remember what her pseudonym is. Diana Windsor, Princess of Wales, Princess of Hearts, whatever the fuck her name was. I think that was the Rubicon. I like everything, much like when the Rubicon was crossed. Caesar didn't obviously appear with no backstory on the Rubicon and crossed it. There's a huge amount that goes into, and most of it unrelated, that goes into why that exact moment in 1997 was the moment Britain kind of lost, popped its clogs, went crazy. But yeah, and my theory is that due to, without going too much into it, we're going to be talking about it, but the loss of the empire, the membership of the EU, the loss of all sorts of different things which made Britain this imperial hegemon once upon a time, that combined with also Thatcher's assault on the working class in the 1980s and, you know, and John Major's after that, that it reached this apex point on something which had very little, if nothing, to do with any of those things, which was the chasing of an ex-member of the royal family in Paris and her boyfriend down a tunnel where they accidentally died, in quotation marks, because we all know Prince Philip actually killed them.
Okay. Spicy start. I like it. Suzanne, what is your the moment that you think that the UK lost its mind?
I think it's probably, I think there's probably a lot of different points that you could kind of say where you can kind of see a divergence from maybe common sense. But I suppose for me, it would have been probably, again, linked back to my Jitsi handle. It's kind of Brexit itself, and perhaps maybe the sense of what prompted Brexit in the first place. And I think the main thing for me, what stood out, because I actually only moved here post 2016, or actually I was in London when actually they voted to leave. And I just remember there was this, with the group of people that I was with, about three or four of us were all from different countries and maybe one British person. But what really stood to me when we had that moment was that everyone was just very depressed about what had happened because of just our own opinions about Brexit and things like that. And also just the sheer surprise that it happened. And I think for me, this idea, it was just, we didn't think it would happen. And yet it's for me, that was kind of the moment that stood out for me thinking, what's going on and what has happened in the national sentiment that suddenly has shifted. But as you can say, and Alex is saying as well, like there's probably a lot of things that culminates in these types of moments. And so I suppose that's what we'll be discussing today.
Interesting. That's two sort of very different answers there. So probably the best way to go about it is I'll start with the base of the theory and we'll start moving through time and where we can discuss like specific events that we think that are sort of flashpoints that have led to the point that we're at now. My working theory would first of all is that Meriden cursed England to be the weirdest place in the world until the Britons, the native Britons, take over again. I think that would be as sensible as a reading of history and the situation that we're living through as anything else. But to be a little bit more sensible, Alex,
what James, can you explain what that Meriden thing?
So just very very briefly, Meriden is effectively would be the Welsh name for Maryland, but he actually existed along with another allegory. He was basically a Caledonian, so Welsh speaking madman who did a lot of poetry and was the basis for Maryland. The only reason that Maryland is called Maryland is because it's the French, because Meriden sounds too like Merd, and so obviously the French had to change it. After the very obtuse snippet of history, one of these days we'll actually just probably have to do a Dark Ages podcast that goes along with this one, because we're always fucking talking about the Vikings or the Britons. So I would say that the real flashpoint, or the real starting point of where you want to talk about this period, would be in the 90s, where you have the end of the Reagan and Thatcher era. And so obviously, as we've discussed in the podcast many of the time, neoliberalism is really the straw that's sort of broken the camel's back when it comes to eroding of society and enriching the rich and all these problems that have spun out of that. But in the 90s, I think it was effectively like that bit where, you know, Wile E. Coyote goes over the cliff but hasn't realized that they're about to fall yet. So there's a sense of bliss that things are going to be fine. And I think both in the UK and the US, there's a sense of optimism that, you know, things could only get better, to quote the Tony Blair promotional song by Brian Cox. I'm Brian Cox, I'm here to show you. So what do we think about the 90s? And Alex, obviously it's going to lead into your Diana thing, but we'll take that as the separate note near the end of the 90s section. What do we think about the 90s and the way that it's taken to us to the route that we're at now?
I agree, but in the same way that it's the towards the end of a journey, because you have to, and there's a lot going into that. You have to go into where does Thatcher come from, the post-war settlement, the loss of the empire, the loss of the type of white supremacist horror that was, but the arrival of huge amount of immigration, comparatively huge because of where Britain was at the time, and the idea that one of the documentaries we were watching recently, there was a guy who was being interviewed who described going into the labor exchange in 1967, I think, and being confronted by a Sikh who was behind the desk. And he just couldn't get his head around it. He refused to collect his dole that day because he just couldn't accept the idea that someone he used to, as a former member of the British Army, rule over and lord over was giving him money in a labor exchange. And I think in many ways that kind of process of the loss of the empire, the never coming to terms with it, or the loss of the racial superiority, the arrival of the people who had been colonized into the country, the Rivers of Blood speech by Enoch Powell, the economic disaster of the 70s because of the oil crisis, because of OPEC, etc. It all builds up into this moment in the 90s when you have kind of Britain going down this weird, detached, direction. And I think probably the best example of that is Tony Blair. I mean, Blair is a great symbol of somebody, born after the war, born in this kind of media environment where substance means nothing, where kind of knowing Murdoch and being friends with Rupert Murdoch is all that mattered. He comes into power. And I think, say what you will about John Major, and you can say many, many horrible things, and God knows I would be the first to say it, but he wasn't Tony Blair. And even Thatcher, as horrible and kind of reactionary a person, or not really not reactionary, but a horribly right-wing she was, she had a set of beliefs, powerfully held those beliefs, not my beliefs, but held them. And Major had his own beliefs as well. I just don't really know what Tony Blair believes other than believes in being in power, And I think that's something that has held together everyone who's followed him from Cameron to what's her name? I can't even remember her name. whoever was in power after Cameron and now Boris Johnson, So I think that was the moment for a variety of reasons that the dams burst.
Suzanne, you were growing up in Ireland in the 90s. And obviously that comes with its whole host of good points and bad points, the Celtic Tiger awakening certain sections of society. But what did it feel like looking over at the UK when you were growing up?
I was just growing up in it, so I don't know if I did look over that often. I think the thing when you're Irish, and I think growing up, and I mean Alex can talk about this as well, like growing up in school, is that like I had a history teacher that was definitely pro, like very biased towards Ireland. So all the history I ever learned was all about how Ireland was trying to fight against the Empire of Britain. And so I think in the sense that I probably was really aware of the UK more the historical legacy that it had in the empire itself, perhaps rather than the major events that were happening in the 1990s during in the UK. I think obviously like the Good Friday Agreement was something that definitely stood out in the 1990s in Northern Ireland. And I think part of that process, and that brings also in Clinton in from the US and things like that, and that kind of peace process culminating after like 30 years. I think that's something that is significant and actually was a positive development. And I think that kind of makes logical sense because on all sides, you ended up hopefully having some sort of agreement that led to some sort of peace, whether or not you fully agree that it worked or not. And I think the other interesting thing that I think about when I think about the 90s and the UK and things like that, it's also this idea that if there was this sense of optimism, it's wondering why was there a sense of optimism? And for example, what was it that shifted people from Major to Blair? And as Alice kind of talking about whether, what Blair actually stood for, it's kind of interesting to think about what actually caused that shift, because it seems like every time, I think it was at the end of, Major was like a slight recession at the start of the 1990s, but then you have kind of a economic upswing again. And so it's kind of interesting at that, depending on how people are doing economically, sometimes that can cause shifts in power or shifts in ideology as well. And so I don't really know what potentially was kind of, what was the main kind of movement within that, like within the UK in the 1990s?
I would say, I think our overall sort of thing that we're looking at is that the reason that, say, the USA is, or definitely was, a much, much stranger place to be around, to live in, to see its culture, was that it didn't really have the post-war settlement that the UK did. Like, I think Henry Rollins puts it quite correctly when he says that, you don't live the American dream, you survive America, you don't live there. And going into the 90s, even if there is, sort of some boost to the economy, people are not really feeling it on a large basis. You've also got the ascendancy of Christian fundamentalism I mean, it'd always been there, but I think it starts really getting a new foothold in the 90s for a variety of different reasons, especially partly coming out of the AIDS crisis, where that was handled so badly by both sides of the Atlantic and by the press and politicians that a lot of scaremongering was able to push people down that road. But say Christian fundamentalism, or, you know, crazy Christianism, wasn't too much of a thing in the UK. It still had its, you know, its Protestant background and Church of England, and so it was a bit more tolerant when it came to dissidents of a religious nature within the press. And it definitely felt, growing up, now obviously maybe a lot of people would be willing to disagree with this, but it felt that in the UK you had a little bit more room to not be part of the mainstream and to sort of stand outside of, you know, slightly what was acceptable, especially in terms of, say, comedy and music, where I think the 90s is the last time where you actually see any innovation. Now, whether you like it or not, I think it's fair to say that there is innovation in music, in film, in the art world. And I don't think we see that at all now. And we can go into various reasons of why, but it definitely ends in the 90s. And the reason why we don't see it is because of things that happened in the 90s. So I think that's some of your reasons, you know, but you both have, you know, Clinton and Blair, who effectively both win on the idea of, well, what we'll do is just what the other side are doing, who've been winning for the past 20 years. We'll just do what they're doing, but slightly nicer. And again, that sort of sows the seeds for the situations that we're really living through now. Alex, what do you want to say about that?
I just want to kind of bounce off that by saying that, like, I kind of mentioned it a second ago, but I think something that really needs to be talked about in regards, and it's America as well, but it's more with Britain, is the power of Rupert Murdoch. You have to understand that, like, he bought the News of the World in 69. He bought the Times, I think the Sunday Times, in the 80s, which he legally shouldn't have been allowed to do, and just became this enormous media. Baron's not enough, emperor, really. The amount of power he wields and wielded from the 90s really heavily onwards, it was enormous. You can see his kind of his anti-intellectual, his anti-Europe. He once said that the reason why he has a problem with Europe is that he can't just drive up to Brussels in his car and see the head of the European Union whenever he likes, whereas he said, I can easily do that to the Downing Street. And I do think that there's a kind of a Murdochization of Britain that began at that time. And it, obviously it's happened in America as well, but there's a much more balanced media in America. And I know that sounds strange. There is definitely a liberal media in Britain, in America, where there's not in Britain. Britain has become completely dominated by Murdoch or Murdoch-like papers. And the media and the BBC has bounced off that because the Tories are in power and other reasons as well. But they kind of just follow the tabloids. So I think to not mention him and his huge influence on British society and the type of schizophrenic, sociopathic way of talking and thinking about things, you know, began, you know, kind of to gain its huge power in the 90s more than anything.
Yeah, I just had two questions, maybe kind of probably like bouncing off what Al say about Rupert Murdoch. My first thing would be, I would contest a little bit that all the media in the UK is that. I mean, yes, there is the examples of what you're talking about and the level of control he has, and I agree, and I definitely with the tabloids and stuff like that. But there are certain papers that do try a bit more of a balanced or maybe more left of centre, potentially at the Guardian and stuff like that. Maybe that is still certainly biased, but I do think that there is some balance out there if you can find it. But I do agree with you in terms of the level of power that he has. But my other question kind of linked to that would be more about, does the media necessarily, like, who creates the media? Obviously, Rupert Murdoch is doing it because he's trying to make the most amount of profit, and simply as that, or also try and promote his own ideas of whatever they are. But is the kind of change that you see in the media, if you say there has been a shift, say, from the 1990s into the 2000s, into the modern day in the UK or in the US, is that a shift that's reflected because society has shifted? Or is the causation more that media is shifting and therefore that influences more public opinion? Because that's kind of linking back to what you're saying about when kind of this kind of whole movement kind of talked about. Sorry, Alex, go ahead.
I'll just respond with one sentence, which is a quote, which is that politics is downstream of culture and media is culture.
I kind of got 2 points there. First of all, I think that when you're talking about Murdoch, in some ways, the reason that we're seeing the UK overtake the US in its weirdness was that there was structures there within the press culture and within government that was a buffer between the worst excesses of Murdoch and the way that he operates. Again, because of the post-war settlement, the idea of the way that society was that didn't exist in the US. And so that meant he was able to set up Fox News and just go completely balls to the walls crazy and grab, you know, the people that he wanted on that way. You know, he basically had free reign in America. Which I think it was more of a, you know, an ongoing war in from the 80s and the 90s into the noughties for Murdoch in the UK. It was, there was more people willing to call him out into some aspect. And yeah, I think you're right to bring that up, Alex, because now he's won so succinctly that every media output in the UK is deeply, deeply strange for a variety of reasons. But I think to say that The Guardian shows the other side is a ridiculous statement to hold because of its huge endemic turf problem that exists with inside of it. And also the way that it, you know, has now purposely got rid of any of its leftist credentials that might have existed in the 90s and has effectively a neoliberal newspaper that now, despite his, you know, dogshit polling and personality and way about going things, is still effectively back in Stammer. It has people like John Rentoul on its books, and, you know, Hud Polly Toynbee and Suzanne Moore and people like that who really show you the worst of what the 90s was, and sort of brings you to the idea that culture froze in the 90s in the UK. It hasn't moved since then. The comedians that we had in the 90s are still the comedians that we have now. The people that are in the newspapers are still the new people in the newspapers now. Yeah, some politicians have changed, but The Guardian spends all of its time now saying, like, oh, we should bring Blair back, despite the fact that Blair is a deeply, deeply unpopular politician. And what they basically remember is, like, one election that went well for him, and then two that were... still got in, but that's more to do with quirks of the UK electoral system than it is to do with his popularity as a person. So this should take us nicely into Diana, though, because this is Alex's theory that it was Diana that broke the brain. For me, I'm not quite sure with that. I kind of know, understand what Alex is saying, but a sort of shrieking, like over-emotional grief, it's kind of like a UK thing because of the way that the royal family has been produced over the past however long. I think it also comes from a post-Victorian thing where basically in the Victorian era, death was so prevalent in society that, you know, it was dark, but people were slightly able to deal with it better. And something's happened where now death has become such a taboo. If you want to know my story of how I find out about how Diana died, which I feel is very 90s, I was expecting to go to Portobello Beach to see Rhino, the gladiator, do a show. And it was cancelled because of Diana's death. So really, I was a real victim. But Alex, if you want to delve into why you think that Diana's... death is the Rubicon moment.
Well, I think it certainly I don't, litmus test is the wrong word, but it certainly shows that there'd been a crack. Whether in and of itself it caused the crack, I don't think so. I think the cracks were already there. But it certainly showed the problem with the way British people were thinking. And I can sum it up in one story, which will be linked at the bottom of the podcast. It's a reference to a documentary actually done by Christopher Hitchens back in 1998, and it was called The Morning After, as in morning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. And it's this guy who was looking to put a teddy bear in front of Westminster Palace, which made no sense because she wasn't a member of the royal family anymore. And he couldn't find any. They'd been sold out. Obviously, people were putting lots of stuff in front of the gates. And so he bought an E.T. doll, and he put it in front of Westminster. And one of the guards went up quite soon afterwards and picked it up to get rid of it because it's fucking E.T. And the guy punched the guard, knocked him out, and was caught on camera. And I think in a weird way, that kind of image of just this detached, like, again, Diana was somebody who, A, was a member of the royal family, B, was not this blushing violet destroyed by, well, maybe to some extent she was, but she certainly was not some saint. Multiple members of the royal family, multiple people in general, had done charity work, but had been ignored. She was a figure who knew how to manipulate the media. But she was cast as this dejected, destroyed woman while she was heading around the world shagging Dodi Al-Fayed. I mean, it was so palpably, and all these papers, who a day before had been attacking her, spent the day lauding her as this saint, and ever since has been lauding her as this martyred saint. And I just think that as a symbol of this detached from reality, because if batshit is anything, it's a detachment from reality, then that kind of moment was the first symbol I can obviously think of that. And it follows on the footsteps of what I said about Murdoch, you know, the rise of kind of the Eurosceptics that have come along since, and just in general, the nostalgia for Downton Abbey, for the Empire, all that stuff. I think in many ways, that was the moment where it was most obviously there was something wrong with the British psyche, you know?
But I think the point is that we're saying that both countries, the psyche was never well. It was never a well-adjusted countries to live in. It's just that one has overtaken the other when it comes to its strangeness. And if, you know, the weird outpouring of grief for Diana is what you think is a breaking point. I kind of get where you're coming from there. What do you think, Suzanne?
I think Alex is right in the sense that, like, the overreaction to people and the sense of mourning was kind of disproportionate to what actually maybe occurred. I think it is interesting that just Diana is a figure, whether or not you want to go in, I'm not going to go into a debate about who she was or what her actual, who she was as a person versus how she was portrayed in the media. But it is interesting that, like, the sheer amount of attention that she got. And in some senses, I think at the time she was definitely the most photographed woman in the world or person. And that kind of is almost an example of how you kind of have this growth of not only just the media presence around certain people, as well as just kind of, I don't know if it's a cult of personality, but it's this idea, I guess it's a growth of celebrities and all this kind of thing. And so I think definitely media and the attention and all those kind of perceptions and how people interact with the media, as well as just have certain reactions to it, definitely feeds into a kind of strange sense of disreality, not disreality, unreality, whatever the word is for it. Because I think it is interesting because it doesn't, as Alex said, like, if you're saying that going batshit crazy is a detachment from reality, in some senses, the media kind of cultivates that image. And I think it is interesting and it is a good point to make.
Cool. So let's maybe move it forward then, as we're going through history to find other people's jumping off points. So I would say that as you get into, like, the early noughties, as you see, you know, Biden, they're all interchangeable, the American presidents in my head. So Clinton's gone, Bush comes in, and over the past, say, 3 or 4 months, I've kind of been thinking about Bush quite a lot for various reasons, because of the way that the media reacted to him, the way that he was discussed in comedy and day-to-day public, and the way that his legacy has sort of been changed, where he's like, oh, well, he was actually quite sensible compared to Trump, where I think in actual, like, in lots of ways, Bush is a much stupider and weirder president than Trump, because Trump is, for better lack of words, as a character, I think he's a facade. I think he sort of has a self-knowing way about going things. I don't think he's as stupid as he makes himself out to be, where I think that Bush is as stupid as he made himself out to be. And the way that he tried to manipulate the media, because, you know, Bush said a lot of very stupid things, but then he always was like, the way that he tried to flip that was like, oh, I'm just human. I'm very normal person. I'm kind of just like you. And it never really flew, where Trump's weirdness is so more genuine. I think that a lot of people see themselves in Trump. They see the childishness, the inability to concentrate, the rudeness. Like, they identify with that a lot more easily. But where you see a sort of difference in the psyches, though, is, you know, because with the media, you know, the liberal media, it's got Bush in, and effectively people like Oliver Stone is going fucking mental, and Michael Moore, who basically don't have problems with Obama, even though they're almost identical in their politics. Where in the UK, you've still got, you know, the sort of the tail end of Blairism, which, for all of its ills, it was better than what was on the horizon. So what do we think about these last little vestiges of the 90s and the early noughties, and how that affected the country's psyches?
I mean, Bush and Blair really is my first proper memory of politics. I mean, if we're going to be very, very kind of true to history, it'd probably actually be the Kosovo War that I first got interested in politics for. But really, 9/11 and Bush and Blair. You could make an argument that the Iraq War and the kind of Blair's treatment of anti-war sentiment, because for those who don't know, it's about 12 million people marched against the Iraq War in 2002 or 2003. I know when the war is, but I mean the marches were all in one day, and there was a million people in London. And Blair has since said that there was nothing anyone could have said that would have stopped him supporting the war. Even if someone had given him 100% proof there was no weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was not a threat. And at the time, everybody knew what the war was about. It was about oil. It was about strategic power. And I think you could make an argument that the sheer brazen lack of interest in hiding what the war was about, and Blair was responsible for that as much as Bush, has had much worse effect on Britain than it has on America. Because America, there's a general acceptance the war was a disaster, and that they were lied into it. Now Bush has been rehabilitated in a really horrible way, because liberals don't actually these days, Democrats don't really give a shit about principles. But the war has not been rehabilitated, and I don't think it will be rehabilitated. Whereas in Britain, you get the impression that if people think about it at all, there is this kind of weird processing of it, which is, I think people all knew what it was about, and the brazenness of that. I can't think of another example of a war in British history other than something in the 19th century where it was so obvious what the war was about. And it wasn't about any of the things people were saying. It was about just sheer greed and the desire to control Iraqi oil reserves, you know? And the hundreds of people that died afterwards, 500 British soldiers died in Iraq, and probably a million Iraqis died. That may also be, again, a reflection of what had begun in the 90s, this, you know, that ideologies, you know, the ideas of what everyday people want, or it became so divorced from the political elite, while at the same time they were talking this kind of liberal rap. So yeah, I think maybe it's like the cognitive dissonance between what is clearly happening and what everyone knew was happening with Blair and with Bush, but yet what they were saying. And again, that's maybe not something completely new to politics, but the brazenness I felt was so much more obvious. And so I suppose that's kind of, when I think of Bush and Blair, it's feeding off something that was already growing in society. It's a huge example. And maybe, you know, maybe more important than Diana. But I do think it's coming out of the 90s, but it's that kind of most horrific example of it.
Yeah, I think you've got a really good point there, because people like, you know, Luke Akerst and John Rentoul and Dan Hodges spend a lot of their time basically defending the Iraq War and Tony Blair and the culture that went around it, and effectively want to see it happen again in this very sick and colonistic way. What do you think about that, Suzanne?
I think Alex is right in the sense that I think the Iraq War probably was like a watershed moment, and I think particularly because, as Alex said, like the vast majority, like there was lots and lots of protests in the UK that seemed very ineffectual at achieving anything. And in some ways, it's kind of the lack of accountability of government to actually what they're saying. They think there's weapons of mass destruction, and yet obviously there wasn't, and it was more to resources and oil and things like that. And so it's interesting that most people knew the facts of what actually probably was trying to happen, but that wasn't what was being said. And I think it's this kind of idea, this kind of disconnect, which is kind of interesting, is kind of probably has had an effect on the different psyche of people in the UK.
Cool. So moving forward a little bit, and I think for my money, this is really when things start to change, because I think both countries are sort of trundling along in a sort of very similar culture, but you know, America is a kind of more cynical place to live. But what you have is the election of Obama, and rightly or wrongly, I think that has given chunks of America a real sense of optimism that the UK just, you know, maybe saw with Blair. But that was fucking shot to bits, in one term. And it's only a very select people that still have that feeling. Unfortunately, they write for The Guardian or, you know, they're on Have I Got News For You. And so it seems like they're in their echo chamber, seems like they're on the money, but obviously are actually a tiny proportion of society. Again, the long 90s, the 90s that never fucking ended in the UK's culture. But, you know, when you talk to Americans, and I was, you know, going out with an American at the time, this idea of like, well, Obama would never get in because America is so racist. And that was basically a lot of people's opinion. And to actually, have a black president, I think, really blew a lot of cobwebs out of the libs anyway of America, because it's, you know, for them it's more about tone than it is about actually what's happening. Now, we all know Obama has really bad politics and basically carried on a lot of the worst excesses of American foreign policy, but at least he appeared to make the right noises when it came to stuff at home and tried to do things with Obamacare, and seemed genuinely upset and tired with the amount of school shootings that he had to be on watch for. And I think America is still coasting on that at the moment. And so that sense of like, oh, well, things can actually improve. They might actually be able to, or, you know, as it actually is like, oh, we can stop thinking about politics and go back to brunch. That has a much more healthy trickle down in society, I think, where what happens in the UK is you have someone like David Cameron come in, who basically sees an opportunity to take an axe to everything in UK society. And that's, I think, really the watershed moment for the UK, where someone like Cameron, who's sort of doing it as a knee-jerk reaction, and starts dismantling basically the few nice things that we had, is really what kind of snaps. So what do you guys think about that?
What do I think about the idea that Obama has a less detrimental legacy on the psyche of the US than Cameron and Osborne, because really it's the two of them, have had on the UK?
Yeah, or just anything from there that you want to sort of dive into, any threads that interested you?
Well, I mean, if you go back to the election in 2010, after the financial collapse, I mean, you could also point out the financial collapse in 2008, 2009 as this major moment where neoliberalism was proven to be an emperor with no clothes, and yet it's still going. Again, that's a big part of this unreal world, what Adam Curtis, I think, used to call, Living in an Unreal World, whatever. It was one of his documentaries from 2016. I'm sorry, I've just been watching a lot of Adam Curtis lately. He's on my head, on my mind. But yeah, I mean, there is this kind of element of, well, we all know that a wealthy elite got away with enormous crimes in terms of what happened with the housing market, what happened with stock market. We know that who caused the collapse, and yet in Britain, the poor were blamed for it, you know, and a lot of people, through sheer weight of propaganda, were led to believe that, even on a very subconscious level. I think that was a horrendous damage, really, that was done to poorer people by things like the bedroom tax, by the response to the riots in 2011, by the support for Syrian war. It should be remembered that Cameron wanted to go to war in 2013 with Syria, as if they hadn't fucking learned from the 10 years previously when Iraq happened. I mean, really could go on, really. The huge propaganda campaign against the Scottish independence, the referendum on the alternative vote, if anyone remembers the alternative vote referendum, that we were living increasingly in a world which was, you know, the elite was detached from reality, or at least propagating an idea of reality which was, you know, palpably false. So I suppose what I think about at that time, and then your theory, or one of your theories anyway, that the story about Cameron fucking a dead pig, or rather putting his cock in the mouth of a dead pig when he was in university, so many people believed it because we were already living in an unreal world. And so, yeah, I do think that it's not the Rubicon. I still think that we crossed that in the 90s, or at some point in the 90s, or maybe the Iraq War, but that this unreal world was all becoming ever more obviously the world that British people in particular were living in. And I think you can see that, if not to zoom ahead, but you can see that in how America voted in 2020 and how Britain voted in 2019, that Boris Johnson got a huge support and the Tories got huge support, whereas Biden won handily with about 8 million votes. Now, we can go into the complexities of that and pandemic and blah, 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 but ultimately that's the score sheet, which is that America has more of a balance of okay, well, this is a bubble of reality here and another bubble of reality there. Maybe a few other little bubbles exist. Whereas in Britain, I get the impression that for a large chunk of the population, exceedingly large chunk, this unreal world is now their own reality. And I suppose Cameron does play a role in that, a big role at that.
Right. So, sorry, excuse me. So I do want to get into the David Cameron pick thing into a little bit more detail. But before we do that, Suzanne, have you got anything to reply or any thoughts you've got there?
I think the only thing I would add in as well is that what you have to think about, I suppose, when we're thinking about how Britain may have changed, or the psyche of Britain would have changed post the crisis, would also have been the austerity that the Conservative government undertook in order, what they were saying was, to reduce the deficit, but also probably the shattering of certain social services that were there, privatization of the NHS and other things like that you can add in. And I think that also would have had a massive effect on different parts of society, and also kind of built into this whole thing. And I think the policy of austerity as well, just as a concept, probably also had a strong influence.
Yeah, the way that I kind of see it is that America didn't have anything. And so austerity was bad. And yeah, it wasn't great for a lot of people. But a lot of people also just didn't lose anything because they never had anything in the first place. Where in the UK, you did have a library and you did have some services for mental health or if you were homeless. And they're all gone now. And that obviously has its, you know, that is an attack. That's a attack on someone's psyche and mental health. And I think that definitely has borne out in the way that the UK has got weirder in our lifetime. The reason that I think the David Cameron pig thing is sort of the real breaking point is because I think it's a very Suez Canal crisis moment in the psyche. And my reasoning for this is that the UK effectively works on an interconnected old boys network, and there's everyone sort of knows it. And it's essential if you want to get to certain parts of society, if you want to be in the BBC, if you want to be high enough in the BBC, if you want to get a job in the Times, if you want to be a journalist, a politician, a civil servant of a certain level, you effectively have to go to the right school, you have to know the right people. And within that, there's a very coded and self-correcting sort of language, mannerisms, these, you know, there's certain things that are allowed to be discussed, there's certain things that are not allowed to be discussed. And I think that what happened with the pig thing, now whether it's true or not, I think it's neither here nor there. I would err on the side that it is true because it fits with the sort of weird things that public school boys will do. And what that serves to do in society is that you have dirt on someone else. So that means like when they become prime minister, you can give them a little nod and go, well, remember the time that you did this. But obviously, so that means then they give you a cushy job, but you're never meant to talk about it. You're never meant to say it out loud because that would be breaking the rules. And what you have here with this, you know, the person writing in the book that this is what David Cameron did, is you have a real break in the establishment where effectively someone has broken the ultimate taboo, where they have actually just mask off said, this is one of the things that have happened in the higher echelons of society. And I think that really caused a real existential crisis in a lot of people's heads because it was the ultimate taboo. You've completely broken this ethic, the one thing that you're not meant to do, which is out the terrible things that you do in society. It was a real mask off thing. And I think a good chunk of people have never really got over that. And what I allowed to do was people like Farage, who is tacitly involved in these groups, but not to the extent that someone like Cameron and Osborne were. And even though Boris Johnson is probably the highest involved in these, has positioned himself outside of that, it really allowed them to move forward in the public sphere and has left out a good chunk of what was the ruling elite are now kind of out in the cold. And it's sort of like a new guard has taken over, even though they look very similar, they talk very similar. But the fact that someone like, you know, a lot of people, when I was asking people on this on Twitter, some of them were saying, like, well, the ascendancy of Jacob Rees-Mogg is really, I think, a turning point in how weird that the UK is. And I kind of know what they mean, but you have to remember with Mogg is that he's new money. He's a city boy who is cosplaying as an old Victorian because deep down he actually feels inadequate because he wasn't really accepted into that community. So what do you guys think about that?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. I think that Cameron's difficult because there's so many things that go on now. I mean, a lot of people really would have been happy enough for Cameron to stay on if he hadn't gone with the referendum, the Brexit referendum, which just shows you how morally bankrupt so many liberals are, is that they didn't really give a shit, or not enough of a shit, about what he'd done with bedroom tax, what he'd done with austerity and various foreign wars. They were fine with that because he presented himself in the right way. I don't know. I kind of feel like that, like I said, what I said before, which is that the unreal world may have been made that much more unreal, and the door of batshit may have been opened further by him. I don't think he's the first one to wedge it open, and I don't think he's the one that kicked it open. Certainly it plays a role in why Britain is moving further and further away from reality. Again, it should be said that I kind of think Britain right now is closer to the bubble of Fox News or One Nation, One American News, or whatever these spin-offs from Fox News are, than it is to where the majority of Americans are. I think James's point about the unbelievable vitriol against trans people in British media is stunning, and it would not be something you'd even see on Fox News. Some of the kind of just horrors there. So yeah, I think it plays a role. I don't think it's the thing. I don't think it's the key event that begins or blows it wide open. I think it's just an addition. But certainly the idea that the elite were able to hide some of the Bullingdon Club bullshit is destroyed. And even today you can see, unless you're a Brexiteer, of course, that most of those who are, say, like the Kenneth Clarks of the world, will be accused in ways that they never would have been before, and thus making at least their section of the elite illegitimate. So yeah, I can see your point, but I disagree slightly.
Yeah, I think I'm good with Alex. I think I get your point, and I think part of British politics, that kind of old boys club, has been there for a long time. Definitely, I think you're right as well, that I think that, like, there's a lot more transparency or access because of just technology and different things in terms of people being able to pass information on more quickly. And it's also potentially, I guess, some of the opinions or things that people have done or have done are coming to air more easily. I don't necessarily know how much of a watershed it was in the sense of making Britain seem more crazy. I think it's kind of, and like everything we're talking about in the podcast, it seems like it's just like one of those kind of like a trip downhill. It's like every single thing that we pass, it just kind of, you build up acceleration as you keep going, right? And I don't know whether or not, you know, we'll just keep going past Brexit and we'll just keep going and we'll just keep accelerating into that kind of unreality or detachment. The other thing, I suppose, the comment I'd also have is that I don't necessarily know if all of Britain, Alex, as you said, is in that bubble. I just wonder, because there's different Britons, right? There's different people living in different parts of it and different like conceptions of who you're talking about. And whether or not you could divide it by class, you could divide it by race, you could divide it by lots of different ways. But I think talking about the UK like it's a homogenous society, and that I think people have a very diverse view. And I don't know, is there any parts of UK society that is more unrealistic or more crazy? I think, obviously, I personally think there is, versus others that aren't. Whether everyone in the country is batshit crazy, I don't really know. But I think it is interesting to make sure to think about that. There is also kind of like different segments of society that might be more or less on that spectrum.
No, I just wanted to say that I think it says a lot when the DUP have much in common with the Tory party, which is more than right now. They have more in common with the Tory party than they've had for 100 years. I think you'd have to go back to the Home Rule crisis in 1913 to find a Tory party and a unionist party that had that much in common. You know, for the most part, DUP was persona non grata amongst the Tories throughout the second half, you know, three quarters of the 20th century. I think they have much in common now in how they behave and what they believe. The only thing that's lacking is the kind of anti-Catholic thing amongst the Tories. But that's not surprising, since Boris Johnson actually was brought up Catholic. And of course, Jacob Rees-Mogg is Catholic too, so it doesn't work as much as it used to. But I think, you know, apart from them, when we talk about the UK in a very horrible way, we kind of always leave out Scotland, because Scotland is already halfway out the door anyway, and so has been so on a different path for 20 plus years now. So kind of maybe I should have been more specific about England, and maybe even more specific as non-London England, you know? So I'll correct myself.
I think when we're talking about these sort of things as well, it is very, very broad views. And it's more to do with the way that, and especially in this podcast specifically, I think it's more to do with the way that the media class talks about itself and views itself, rather than to say more to do with the economic situation. We're kind of real cultural war episode, I would think. Because if you're, say, you know, someone in fucking Swindon that's been on the dole for the past 10, 20 years, your life has got a little bit worse, potentially substantially worse. But it was never great to start off with. And it's the same as if you're in fucking, you know, blue country Kentucky or in Baltimore. Like, your life has been steadily getting worse, I imagine. But it doesn't feel like there's huge changes that have happened, where I think in to the media, they just seem to go from one crisis to the next in their minds. And I think that'll take us on to our last point. I'm going to skip over Scottish independence because we already did an episode where we talked quite a lot about the way that the media was about Scottish independence, sort of moving to Brexit. I've got a couple of points on this that I really want to hit, but since this is your sort of Rubicon, Suzanne, you kick off this bit and then me and Alex will pick up.
I think for me, the reason why I chose Brexit, I mean, part of it is just because it's where my probably own personal experience with the kind of UK kind of insanity may have come into play, but I think it's just significant because it's kind of the end result of a buildup of Euroscepticism within certain parts of society. It also was because it came as such a shock, inverted commas, shock to some people. And I think that's why I kind of chose it as the moment. And it's also kind of the campaigns that were run during the kind of the run up to the actual election in June 2016. And some of the kind of different kind of lies that were espoused by people. I think there was the amount that, you know, I think it was like, I can't remember, it was 325 million or something like that. It was on like the side of a lorry bus. I just remember Nigel Farage or someone else talking about it, where it was like, this money will just go straight to the NHS. And you've all these kind of different lies that kind of, a lot of that comes up on the argument. And it's just how persuasive that seemed to have been for a large segment of, obviously, I can't remember the approximate, was it 51% of the UK population who voted for Brexit. And so it was that convincing. And for me, that's why it kind of stood out for me, is that moment where, for me, it made me realize, okay, something else is going on in terms of the psyche and what's happening in the country around me.
So I think my thing with Brexit, and I've said this multiple times online and on comedy, I don't know if I've actually said it on this podcast before, but I have said that it does amuse me that the least important thing broke, is the thing that finally broke the British mind, which was Brexit. I think overall, you know, definitely from an anarchist standpoint, all the European Union is basically a trade bloc. It's not a fucking great trade bloc at that, but it's kind of better to have it than not to have it, and it comes with a whole host of problems. But being in or out of the EU doesn't really change much for the UK, because it's, you know, can print its own money, and it has access to markets that the UK other countries, you know, don't really have, and all the problems that are blamed on the EU usually start at home. And so to say things like, oh well, you know, the reason that we don't have housing, that's not, you know, that's probably one of the biggest problems in Ireland and the UK. That's not the EU's fault. That's a government, you know, that's central government's problem. So I think something like that, it's effectively unimportant in the large scale of things, is the thing that we've been talking about and discussing, and, you know, people literally shitting themselves out of anger over absolutely nothing. I think I could go with you and say, yeah, this is the point that's going.
I mean, I was just going to make a very brief point, which is, I think the reason why Brexit became this huge issue was because it affected people in upper middle class, that the ability to do business with Europe, the ability to travel to Europe to their second or third house in the Dordogne, was the main reason why the media class and the section of the elite was obsessed with it. I think that's also the same reason why it was going to happen, because there was so much built up anger at the elite that the more they were against it, the more people, section of people who'd been fucked over, or maybe even minds twisted, had to make it happen. It's the same reason, it's become a religion in that regard. And I think that's really a sign. I mean, it's a symptom of this toxic elite that have been around for a long time, and a kind of very unconscious targeting of that, and the thing, you know, by a section of the population. Now, maybe that's giving them too much credit, and maybe it's just it's an anti-immigrant thing, maybe, but probably as well. But I think Brexit is, again, it's a symptom, it's a response, it's an acceleration of a process that's been going on for a while, which is what we've been laying out for this entire episode.
No, I think I agree with Alex and stuff, that I think it is just kind of the end result of different things. I would only say in terms of, I know what you're saying, in terms of like Brexit, is it a big deal or not? I think it depends on what context, in my opinion, I think it depends on what context you're looking at. I think the reason, as Alex was saying, it became such a big deal is because in some ways it was kind of just the issue that two opposing sides decided to kind of finally kind of fight it out or whatever. And so you kind of, whether or not it actually has a material impact on people, maybe not. And definitely things like housing, yes, definitely has more of an impact on people. And I do think in terms of the short term, in terms of the economics of it, Brexit is going to cause problems, potentially not the actual leaving the EU itself, but the actual inability to actually agree to a specific trade deal is going to have issues. Longer term, a medium term, potentially it won't have as big a deal. And I think that's probably true. But I think it's more the interesting mental disconnect in terms of the UK turning its back, inverted commas, on the EU, which is not necessarily what they're doing. But I think that's interesting in the sense that it kind of sends a message to what's happening. And maybe it is, as Alex said, it's just kind of the end process of what has already been occurring for decades.
So yeah, I think the basic theory that we've got to is sort of really the end of empire, and the seeds of Thatcherism has really sped it up. And I mean, I think the USA is much on the same trajectory as the UK. And I think it's more within its DNA to be a much more horrible and nasty place, because of the way its constitutions and its houses are houses of parliament. Senate, et cetera, are set up. But as I was saying, like, I think they're sort of, they've got these little glimmers of hope. Again, Biden, obviously, you know, we're how many days in, a month in or so, and he's basically gone back on every promise that he said he was going to. And at the time that we're recording this podcast, you know, there's ongoing situations in places like Texas that are not being dealt with at all. And it's been left to people like AOC to do more fundraising for it than, you know, the government that these people are paying nominally, you know, taxes to. So maybe at some point we'll do it'll flip, and you know, things can change and the UK might calm down a little bit. But at the moment, it's a paedophile ridden, rainy island filled with turfs, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. So
wait a second. That's our fucking intellectual property. We used to do that.
Well, I was saying this on Shinan's stream. If you don't follow Shinan Costa, that I'm often on his stream, but I was saying about the weird thing about Ireland was that was its you know, our identity has been taken over by the UK, where they've really, I mean, it's always been there, but they've really out-nonced Ireland by a huge, huge, huge step at the moment. So as we see things going forward, to see us out, I'm going to ask you, what sort of mad event do you plan or expect to see happening in the next, say, 5 or 6 years that would be similar to something that we're talking about now?
What mad event will appear? I don't know. I could see the Royal Navy being sent into the English Channel and shelling migrant dinghies. They've already kind of, you're already pretty close to that already now. So that's not that much of a fucking leap. I can absolutely see it doing that. I could see them also being sent into the English Channel to shell Spanish fishing boats or something like that. I could see conflict in Gibraltar between the Spanish and the English. I could see, if they wanted to, I don't think they would, but there's even a chance of them being sent into Northern Ireland as well. I think basically anything that looks like what the British Empire would have done in the late 19th century, but in a really shishy fashion, I could see happening. I could see LGBT laws being rolled back as well. Well, LGB, because obviously the T is already being attacked. Yeah, I mean, anything really, at this point, anything that furthers this the illusion that a certain section of the population is living in and the media class is living in, you can follow that down into the rabbit hole. So basically anything that makes us more like 1890s Britain, but with a much, 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 much smaller army and navy and a much bigger media platform, I could see happening.
I think in terms of craziness events that could happen, I mean, it's not crazy. I think Scottish independence is definitely something that potentially is going to happen. I don't think that's crazy. I just think that's probably on the cards. I think the UK are trying to build a bridge or something. At some point, they were talking about building a bridge to Northern Ireland. I think the transport chiefs have talked about trying to build a tunnel to Northern Ireland and to obviously connect the islands, which is not necessarily crazy, but it is questioning why they want to do it. I think in terms of the future, I don't know. I think maybe try and like push the UK further and further actually away from the EU. I'm not really sure in terms of what events I could think of that could happen.
I just want to throw in there that I definitely think they're going to bring back the death penalty.
Those are probably the last thing to say, but what I think is going to happen, and I'm going to say it's going to happen this year, and I'll probably be wrong, but I'm sure it'll happen at some point. But there's going to be a flood in England. It's going to be a huge, huge flood, like something that we haven't seen quite yet. Really devastating. We've seen floods recently, like over the past couple of years, but it'll be one that's sort of slightly above what we've seen before. And like last time, there won't be much movement from the government. But what will happen is they'll send in the troops and they'll end up firing on and killing protesters or citizens or, you know, whatever the situation is. But I feel with a huge amount of certainty that scenario will play out, because as we've seen from the COVID crisis, the Boris Johnson's government inability and unwillingness to actually use the mechanisms of the state to protect its citizens, but actively work against them. I feel that's something that is definitely going to happen. So that all that's left to say is there's another cheery podcast for everyone. We are on the lookout for another co-host to join us in a regular, bi-regular joint. So either give us an email, which is anarchistreadings@gmail.com, get us on Twitter, or send a carrier pigeon, whatever floats your boat. So I have been UK Crazy, your host, James. I was joined by Morning Diana, who is Alex. Say goodbye, Alex.
Goodbye, folks. Remember, Diana was the Princess of Hearts.
And Brex Shit, aka Suzanne.
Bye, guys. Have a lovely evening.
Right, and we'll see you next week, folks. Ooga booga!